It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Martha McCallum.
I'm Bill Hemmer.
I'm Shannon Bream, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Tuesday, January 2nd, 2024. I'm Dave Anthony. We've made it to another election year, and the polls show former President Trump is still way ahead in Iowa, poised to win the first Republican contest in 2 weeks.
I think there's a scenario where Nikki Haley does better than expected in Iowa, which gives her momentum going into New Hampshire.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. A housing market at a standstill did not help the economy over the past year, but the news out of the last Fed meeting is giving everyone in this sector hope that real estate will start moving again.
What we're expecting in 2024 is a pricing back in of housing demand and gains for certain kinds of housing activity, including single-family home building.
I'm Liz Peek. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Happy New Year, an election year, and it all begins in just 13 days, the Iowa caucuses.
Iowa represents this country more than any place, and it also represents tradition.
And former President Trump told a Hannity town hall there on Fox last month, the polls show he should win big.
If Trump loses, he will say it's stolen no matter what. Absolutely. He will try to delegitimize the results. He did that against Ted Cruz in 2016.
Now, Ron DeSantis is in a tight race for second in Iowa with Nikki Haley, who's been surging, especially in the polls in New Hampshire, which has a primary 3 weeks from today. But the Florida governor is banking on a big showing in Iowa.
Ron DeSantis seemed like that was a place where he would make a stand or make a statement early on, but he's come down there about as much as he's come down everywhere else.
Darren Shaw is a professor of government at the University of Texas, a member of the Fox News National Decision Team, and he's in the bipartisan Fox News polling group.
The other candidates have not kind of rallied any sort of support, particularly Nikki Haley in Iowa, the way they have to a lesser degree in New Hampshire and in South Carolina. So, you know, barring something really unusual happening in the last couple of weeks, and of course, nothing unusual ever happens in American politics.
Yeah.
It looks like Trump is in pretty good shape. Plus, it's interesting. In 2016, the kind of reputation of the Trump campaign was that they're not really good on the ground. They don't necessarily know the rules the way some of the other Republican candidates had. That is completely flipped in 2024. He seems to be the master, you know.
Yeah, they say he has a good ground game there. And, of course, the polls have given him, 30-point leads in Iowa. Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, he has been going everywhere in Iowa, every county. He wants to go to some places twice. He wants to meet everybody. And that's what you're supposed to do in Iowa, right? But it hasn't given him any kind of a boost in polling.
I think it's as simple as his message just isn't really resonating, right? It's not clear. He's not Trump, but he's not really a critic of Trump or offering a distinct vision from Trump. The kind of focus on anti-woke politics that animated the early part of his campaign didn't really seem to catch anybody's imagination. And so, I think he's a candidate with a pretty good resume, but it's unclear exactly what his message is and what his lane is.
You know, and it's interesting because he even got the endorsement of the governor, Kim Reynolds, much to, the detriment, to a lot of course, criticism from former President Trump. But she backed DeSantis, and he didn't get a bump out of that either.
No, and a lot of the things, as you said, endorsements, building organization, pressing the flesh, going out there and doing the meet and greets. We all think that matters in these early contests. But I tell you, if the candidate can't connect with voters, if the message doesn't match the moment, it doesn't seem to make much of a difference. And I think that's Ron DeSantis' fundamental problem right now.
Okay, now, Iowa in the past has not had a really good track record of picking the Republican nominee. You can go back to Huckabee, you can go back to Cruz and Santorum. I mean, none of those ended up being
President Cruz,
yeah,
President Buttigieg.
Yeah, none of those guys, right? Especially in the Republican side, it doesn't seem to be the case. Is there a chance of a surprise result that DeSantis does a lot better than we think, that Haley does a lot better than we think? I mean, has Iowa shown that before?
It has. You can surprise. I think, you know, maybe on the Democratic side, we kind of think more of these than on the Republican side. I remember reading about the reaction of the Clintons when Barack Obama won the Iowa caucus.
Right.
Convinced that Obama was, you know, illegally bringing busloads of Illinois voters over and things like that. Conspiracy theories seem to be bipartisan these days. At any rate, there is a little bit of a history of surprise. The one I think of historically was George H.W. Bush surprising Ronald Reagan way back in 80 when Reagan was the, you know, dominant front runner. But you're right. It doesn't necessarily mean much. Looking for a surprise, what I would suggest is there's very little chance, it seems to us, even if something breaks, as it might in the next few weeks, that Trump won't win, gain the most delegates out, get the most voters to the polls. I'm looking at the number two race, though, as you hinted at. Can Nikki Haley finish second? I think there's a scenario where Nikki Haley does better than expected in Iowa, which gives her momentum going into New Hampshire.
Even if she doesn't do as well as you say she might in Iowa, you look at the polling. She is in three different surveys in the last couple of weeks at or just under 30%. One of the polls has her 4 points back of former President Trump. The others have her around 14 or 15 points back. That's a big change from the last several months. She has the backing of a governor there, Chris Sununu. He seems to have helped. Is there a chance? You know, Democrats can vote in the Republican primary. Is there a chance that she could win that?
The electorate in New Hampshire is much better for a candidate like Nikki Haley than the Iowa caucuses. The Iowa caucuses it's a Midwestern state where she's not that well known. It's dominated by the stronghold of the Republican Party, which is essentially MAGA these days. They control the organization. They're used to participating. They, you know, participated in 2016. He's got that place. New Hampshire's a different animal. Independents can vote, decline to states as they're listed in their New Hampshire registrations. Democrats can cross over if there's no interesting contest on the Democratic side, which there does not appear to be.
I mean, President Biden's not even on the ballot there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So what's the downside? And New Hampshire voters are notoriously kind of flinty. They're kind of a more iconoclastic but not populist breed of Republicans. And Haley's message and Haley's persona seem to me to be a pretty good fit there in a way that Trump has never been a great fit in New Hampshire. So there is a scenario. And that then, you know, the question is, would that then make her the flavor of the day? You know, maybe there's more negative news from Trump on the legal front and you're moving to South Carolina, which is an open primary as well, even though there will be a Democratic contest and Biden's on contesting there. So if you squint hard enough, you can see this.
Okay.
But it does take some squinting, admittedly.
Now, obviously, Nikki Haley is a former governor of South Carolina. She's well known there. She could do well there, even if she didn't have a great performance in Iowa or in New Hampshire. But let's get back to Governor DeSantis. If he finishes fourth in New Hampshire, let's say Trump wins, Haley comes in a close second, she does well, Christie gets third. If DeSantis finishes fourth, there's been already talk that his fundraising might be an issue. Can he move on?
You know, it's always a matter in this modern era of the willingness of the candidates to continue or not. You know, think back to 2020. Buttigieg and Klobuchar just packing their bags up after South Carolina and basically sort of throwing their lot in with Joe Biden. That was a pretty stunning development to me. The Democratic Party sort of, all the opposition sort of collapsed and coalesced around Joe Biden as quickly as it did.
Right, because he finished fifth in New Hampshire and people thought he was weak, and suddenly South Carolina changed the game immediately.
It was unbelievable how, Biden was a disaster in Iowa, was a disaster in New Hampshire, lost in Nevada, won a state everybody expected him to win in South Carolina. And yet the reaction on that was, okay, we've got our candidate.
You're right.
Packed it up and went away. A small note, too, I thought that was really interesting. One of the things in 2020 that I thought would insulate Bernie Sanders, who, of course, had all the momentum prior to that. From Biden's momentum was the early voting that takes place in the Super Tuesday states. Places like California, Texas, et cetera, have extensive early voting. But Bernie never banked his vote in those states. He has younger supporters, and they never got their ballots in. So when the momentum hit, it really shook everything up because so many people had waited until Election Day or very late in the contest. I'll be interested to see if Trump learns from that mistake, right? If you're Trump right now, you want to bank as many early votes in these early March contests as possible in case something changes.
Right. Right.
You know, and your environment isn't as good as we're saying, like coming out of South Carolina, who knows?
Right.
You never know.
And he has a lot of legal, he has a lot of legal issues to deal with, whether it's the ballots or civil or criminal cases.
Exactly. Right. The context right now, Trump's electoral situation, we'll set aside his legal, et cetera. Is sort of optimal. So now is when you want to be banking those absentee votes and early votes in those places.
I want to ask you also about President Biden. He doesn't really have strong challenges. Marianne Williamson isn't polling much. Congressman Dean Phillips doesn't poll much. You know, obviously, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is off the Democratic side and running as independent. His polling, President Biden's polling, is not good. His approval ratings come in at, you know, record lows depending on different polls. His numbers, he loses head-to-head in a lot of surveys against former President Trump if there is a rematch in 2024. What do you think he can do to flip that script?
Boy, I tell you, two things that are obviously on the minds of the Biden campaign team right now. The first is, to the extent that they can either influence the economy or influence people's perceptions of the economy. This was behind the whole Bidenomics initiative of last summer, to rebrand sort of the good economic news is associated with Bidenomics. And, you know, so they're still working on that. I keep having flashbacks to George H.W. Bush in 92, when even though the economy was in recovery, voters had absolutely written off George H.W. Bush's stewardship of the economy, right? So Biden's still fighting that fight. That's sort of number one. The second thing I think is a little less obvious. They, meaning the Biden people, keep talking about, well, this is going to be a choice, not a referendum. That's wrong. It's two referendums. There's a referendum. What do you think of the 4 years Biden was president compared to the 4 years Trump was president? I don't think they're thinking that. But they're going to need to, because as my good friend Arnon Mishkin, who's on the decision team at Fox, said, I thought this was really insightful. Arnon said, memories of Trump's administration froze sort of February 28, 2020, right?
Yeah, COVID.
The COVID stuff didn't affect people's impressions of how the economy was under Trump was sort of all pre-COVID. And so I'm not sure the Biden people have come to grips with the fact that for a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, their perception is the economy under Trump was good. The economy under Biden is bad.
Well, we've a lot of time to get to that possible rematch as 2024 begins with the Iowa caucus is just now 13 days away. The first contest. Darren Shaw, professor of government at the University of Texas, member of the Fox News National Decision Team and on the bipartisan Fox Polling Group. Great to talk to you. Happy New Year. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is Liz Peek with your Fox News commentary coming up.
At the closing bell, December 13th, 2023, the markets rallied after Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said they would not raise rates and that Federal Open Market Committee members aren't anticipating the need to raise rates.
The median participant projects that the appropriate level of the federal funds rate will be 4.6% at the end of 2024, 3.6% at the end of 2025, and 2.9% at the end of 2026.
One of the biggest effects of rate hikes so far has been on the housing market.
After picking somewhat over the summer, activity in the housing sector has flattened out and remains well below the levels of a year ago. largely reflecting higher mortgage rates.
Fox Business reporter Jeff Flock toured a just-sold house with Chicago real estate agent Rebecca Duncan the day after Christmas. And while they acknowledge slightly lower mortgage rates, the vibe has been and still is pretty rough.
It's a very, very tough market without having enough inventory and the prices are getting higher. It is tough.
Sounds like a lot of homes. 350,000 homes affordable this year among the listings. But last year, it was almost double that. Things have gotten worse, not better.
Even so, after Powell's comments, as rates already started creeping down, giving some folks in real estate new hope, Katrina Campins, host of Mansion Global, told Fox Business.
You're seeing major price reductions. You're seeing a lot of incentives. And you are seeing people get off the fence and start looking for homes. But we still have very low supply. And also, Charles, the cost to buy is still 52% higher than to rent.
So what is the real estate and builder industry getting ready for? And is the housing market's sole issue interest rates, or has it been something else as well?
Yeah, I think from the housing perspective, we are now past peak mortgage interest rates.
Robert Dietz is the chief economist at the National Association of Home Builders.
Which looked like they were set roughly in late October. We saw mortgage rates approach 8%, which was a multi-decade high. It certainly priced out a lot of demand. We still lack inventory in the market. So housing affordability and construction costs are still an issue. But what we're expecting in 2024 is a pricing back in of housing demand and gains for certain kinds of housing activity, including single family home building.
Mm. Okay, so if you Googled just the words housing market recently, one article says a look back on the year the housing market froze over. And that was next to an article that said experts predict housing market turnaround next year. So let's start with the frozenness. What was the frozenness of 2023 and maybe before that even entirely attributable to rate hikes, like mortgage rates approaching, as you said, 8%, or was something else making things even more sticky? Was it inflation? Was it something else?
If we think about the resale market, I think there's two fundamental factors that kind of froze in place the market. One was short run, the really dramatic increases in interest rates that began in the first quarter of 2022 resulted in the mortgage rate lock-in effect. This is the idea that an existing homeowner who has a 2 to 3% 30-year fixed rate mortgage because of refinancing is unlikely to put their home on the market for purchase. Because
that became a meme. That became a meme, actually. If you locked in at 2 to 3%, you were like, you know, king.
Never. Never get rid of that mortgage. So that has, in the short run, limited the amount of inventory in the market. If you look at the resale single family inventory data, the count of homes that are on the market is about half of what it should be. Month supply is somewhat less than 4 months in a market that really needs 5 to 6 months supply. And home building has attempted to fill in some of that gap. Historically, new single family homes have represented 10 to 15% of total inventory of the market. Right now, they're a full third of inventory of the market. Of course, there are limiting factors on how much additional housing supply that home builders can provide. The industry still faces challenges with respect to the availability of skilled labor, the availability of building lots and zoning rules, and of course, ongoing issues with building materials and even the loans that builders and land developers take out to finance their conditions. And that speaks to the second factor that limited the amount of inventory and sales in the market in 2023, which is a long-term factor, which is that we have underbuilt housing in the United States since roughly with the end of the Great Recession.
I was going to ask you about that. If we had more, because when I was in California, there was this, we talked about that all the time, that we were short anywhere from 1 to 3 million housing units. And I think that includes rental units as well. But nationwide, we're talking about being short a number of units. I can't seem to find a firm number. Is it anywhere from 2 to 6 million? Like, how much do we need?
So there's a variety of estimates. Our team thinks right now the country as a whole is short 1.5 million homes. That's a sum of single family and multifamily. There are certainly larger estimates out there. There's a lot of estimates that put it at 4 million, some at 5 million or higher. Just about everyone, though, agrees that we're short on housing units. And our characterization, our analysis indicates that the reason for that shortage is that from roughly 2012 until the end of 2019, the supply side factors in the home building industry, including a lack of skilled workers, because the industry lost 1.5 million workers during the Great Recession. And it's not a big surprise, the combination of low supply, greater demand with historically low mortgage interest rates, and then home prices increase from 30% to 40%, not keeping up with income growth over the last few years. So that's driven housing affordability down. And this is our big policy message, which is that the only way to really tame some of these housing affordability challenges is ultimately on the supply side of the economy. Demand side policies are not going to work. We simply have to build more attainable, affordable housing, single family and multifamily, for sale and for rent.
What about zoning? Are you looking at zoning and saying, wow, this is contributing to a big part of the problem?
That's right. It is one of the policy elements. There's a large number of them, but rigid zoning laws that essentially make builders use too much land to produce a community is a big challenge. So in New England, for example, the typical lot size of a newly built single family home is almost a full acre. That's too large. So in markets where we have seen some ability to build light touch density, so this is still single family housing, it's still for sale, it still offers the dream of home ownership, but where you offer some additional ability to build with density, we have seen some improvements. A good example of that is the townhouse construction market. Mm-hmm. Right now, about 17% of single family homes that are built are townhouses. And that is a multi-decade high, and it really speaks to a certain kind of buyer that wants to get into home ownership, wants a single-family home, but is looking for a walkable neighborhood. That kind of light touch or gentle density is certainly in demand in markets that will zone for it. I think too often what we see in place, though, is one extreme or the other. Markets where you can only build single-family and large-lot single-family, or markets where they're really trying to promote high-rise multifamily. And so that results in then the missing middle. We don't build enough duplexes. Right. We don't build enough townhouses. The problem is in a number of markets where they have moved to make some of these zoning challenges, you still have the other underlying challenges that are limiting the amount of homes supplied to the market. So just moving the zoning rules themselves does not fix the problem.
Okay. At what point is it smarter to rent rather than buy? We've always had this debate, right? Like, are we at a place right now where it actually does make more sense to rent if you're at close to 8% mortgage rates?
I think maybe we could have had that discussion a couple of months ago, but our general take on the housing market, and this has been fairly consistent in my research over the last couple decades, is that there's a time to rent and a time to buy. Typically renting is at the start of your career, particularly if you're single, prior to marriage. If you expect to move in a short period of time or you're in a high mobility job, then renting probably makes sense. And we need to ensure that the multifamily market and the single family rental market are providing an available supply of rental housing. In the long run, there are distinct social and individual level benefits to homeownership. That's clear in the literature. It helps communities that have high homeownership rates. It helps wealth accumulation, health outcomes, and education outcomes. We think by the end of next year, the typical 30-year fixed rate mortgage is going to be around or just under 6.5%. And that means housing affordability conditions are improving. And so this is a market opportunity, given your career circumstances and where your income levels are, to maybe explore the market in a little bit more detail.
Interesting. I got one more for you that's like, I think we kind of touched on it, but the notion of converting retail, converting commercial, because what are you hearing about this empty commercial space? What can you do with it? Especially as we talked about with zoning. I mean, what are you supposed to do there? You'd have to change a lot of rules, regulations and laws to convert retail or commercial space into residential, I imagine.
Converting high-rise office buildings in the largest metropolitan areas is a very difficult task in terms of converting those buildings over to residential. I think all you need to do is look at Google Maps and you can kind of identify what is an office building versus what's a residential building. Residential buildings tend to have a non-cube type shape because when you have an apartment, whether it's owned or rented, it's got to have windows. It's got to have different kinds of building systems. So you can't just simply take an existing office building and quickly convert it as is into a residential building. It's very expensive. It takes a long time. It requires code changes and building code type changes. But there is a great opportunity here if we're talking about more medium density real estate markets and converting those to residential. So for example, a shopping mall that's gone vacant, with public support and appropriate changes in zoning, you can easily imagine how a shopping mall could be torn down and then the footprint of that real estate converted over to an urban village that has townhouses, low-rise multifamily, and then commercial buildings in the middle, grocery stores, theaters.
Interesting. Okay. Well, Robert Dietz, Chief Economist at the National Association of Home Builders, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. Good to join you. Happy holidays.
I'm Gianna Gelosi with your Fox True Crime Minute. The house where four University of Idaho students were killed last year has been demolished. It marks an emotional milestone for the victims' families and a close-knit community that was shocked and devastated by the brutal stabbings. The owner of the rental home near the university campus in Moscow, Idaho, donated it to the university earlier this year. Students Ethan Chapin, Zana Kernodal, Madison Mogan, and Kaylee Goncalves were fatally stabbed there in November 2022. Some of the victims' families have opposed the demolition, calling for the house to be preserved until the man accused of the murders has been tried. Brian Koberger, a former criminology graduate student at Washington State University in neighboring Pullman, Washington, has been charged with four counts of murder. A judge entered a not guilty plea on Koberger's behalf earlier this year. No trial date has been set. There's more on this story at foxnews.com. Subscribe to the Fox True Crime Podcast with Emily Campagno. I'm Gianna Gelosi with your Fox True Crime Minute.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Liz Peek. What's on your mind?
Democrats are marching through various stages of grief as they contemplate President Joe Biden running for re-election in 2024. They have variously been hopeful, worried, frantic, and now they're getting downright angry. Far-left columnist Harold Meyerson, editor of the liberal magazine American Prospect, is furious that more Democrats have not jumped into the race. His latest piece asks, are the Democrats sleepwalking to disaster? The former Washington Post writer says Biden has been an excellent president, but is concerned that he is the candidate least able to defeat Donald Trump. Those are his words. Meyerson is certainly not alone. A rising chorus of Democrat voices are urging Biden to step aside, including now, apparently, Barack Obama. The question is, who might replace Biden? Meyerson lofts Gavin Newsom as a possibility, but notes that the California governor, quote, lacks appeal to working class voters. He also throws Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer into the mix, but supposes she would face misogynistic hurdles, deploying one of Hillary Clinton's many excuses for losing in 2016. He totally ignores Vice President Kamala Harris, as do most commentators, even though tossing her aside could be risky for Democrats. For months, Newsom has been the favorite candidate of elite liberals. He's reliably progressive, telegenic, and has been running a stealth campaign to introduce himself to American voters. Unfortunately for Newsom backers, the governor is slip-sliding towards oblivion. If Newsom falls appropriately by the wayside, could Governor Gretchen Whitmer be up next? Unlike Newsom, she represents an important swing state, and her favorability ratings in Michigan are better than the president's. Politico reports that Democrats outside of Michigan have encouraged her to run, including members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Also, a female candidate could help Democrats next year keep the focus on abortion. Polling shows Whitmer competing against Donald Trump more successfully than Biden, Harris, or Newsom. Harris, of course, is the obvious replacement should Biden bow out. But her approval ratings are even worse than the president's, despite numerous efforts by her team and the White House to gin up support. Newsom, Whitmer, and Harris are all likely contenders should Biden withdraw from the race. Given their likely electability, Joe may be forgiven for staying put. This is Liz Peek, Fox News contributor.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.